Deputy Vice Chancellors, Mr. Dean, Professor Wilson, colleagues, my students, my family, friends and guests, I feel deeply honoured to stand here tonight. I'm particularly honoured that you came tonight, the night before a public holiday and long weekend, to listen to me talk about economics and transformation. Indeed, it may seem presumptuous that I, as a pale male, should choose to talk about that topic. Some people have argued that people like me shouldn't be talking at all, that given where we've come from, given the history of South Africa, given the role that people like me have played in that history, that basically we should not be offering diagnoses and analyses, that we should leave the political arena, the public arena, to others to remake this society in their form. And that we should actually just step back in humility and shame, and we should just keep quiet. So, should I talk? I could try to deliver a silent lecture, but it wouldn't be much fun. It would be deeply unsettling. It would be in violation of a whole lot of the norms that kind of bind us together. You've come here on the night before a public holiday to listen to me, so that's my job to speak, so I'd better get on and do it. But before I do that, I want to just remember that actually my ability to speak, our ability to speak as a nation, is based on a history of silences. There were a whole lot of people who over many years were silenced, whose voices couldn't be heard. And in fact, one of the most shocking moments for me in my development as a young academic was when I arrived at the University of Natal and discovered that there had been huge events, National Women's March, that were completely written out of the history books that I had seen at school. I just never got to hear about that. This stuff had just been shut up. There were a whole lot of people who were banned and who couldn't speak. And in fact, given where we are today, we should remember that 50 years ago this week, Nelson Mandela was arrested and disappeared into prison. So I do want to talk, and I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about the economic transformation of South Africa, or perhaps the lack of it. I want to talk a little bit about the economics of that transformation process, really ask the question, why do we still see so much poverty and inequality? And then talk just a tiny little bit about the transformation of economics, what sort of things we as economists might do. In order to get there, I'll take a little bit of a meandering road, a little bit like my path through academia, but I'll get to these topics in the end. So I want to begin telling a story, and the story starts 25 years ago in August 1987. South Africa is under a state of emergency. The national leadership of the UDF is getting rounded up. Somebody that is fairly famous these days in that picture. The same thing is true in Pietermaritzburg. So we've got a complete blockout of news. There's police and army are going into the townships, trying to do what they call as re-establish order. But despite all that, Pietermaritzburg is about to explode. Something big is starting to happen. I, at this very moment in time, 25 years ago, am hiding. I'm one of the few people that didn't get rounded up in that dragnet. But I'm also a political scientist at that stage, and I'm trying to understand in my thesis something about how the local government system works. And it's taken me a while to get my head around that, because it is a complete and utter mess. So basically, here we have a diagram which explains how different people were governed. And if you are black, there are at least 1, 2, 3, 4 different types of systems. Within these systems, there are different divisions, and there are different rules for different people within this situation. Even in the rest of the, it's called white South Africa, there are different rules. And what makes this thing really complicated is that the town that I'm studying, Pietermaritzburg, really has all of these, except for independent states, within a very small geographical area. So basically, you have white Pietermaritzburg, which is sitting there with most of the industries, it's CBD. You've got colored Zimbabweans bottled up into a much smaller area there, although there are more people there than in this area. You have Africans in a tiny little enclave of Savanti here, which is basically administered by the Natal Provincial Administration. And you get a whole lot of different areas that are administered in very different kinds of ways over there. One of the really important divisions, one which I will talk a little bit about, is that basically this is the boundary to the KwaZulu-Bantustan. Edendale, sitting there, is a freehold area, old mission land, which is scheduled for removal into Willemdale. But basically, people who live there are ruled in very different ways to people who live there. So basically, here you have chiefs, there you have landowners, and basically in these townships you have yet other systems of administration. What is really important is that basically you can't just decide to live where you want to, and how and where you live determines what kind of services you get and what kind of access you have. The Sibantu area there has first dibs on all the jobs, so the job queue is supposed to start there, then these are next, then these, and these are at the tail end of the queue. And so it goes for education, all the other services. There's a strong hierarchy. Now, one of the things that happens in the system is that basically these divisions are introduced, you find that basically, obviously, the revenue that comes from these things get used essentially here, doesn't get used there or there. So that basically, these administrations here are all bankrupt. And that is one of the things that has led to that sort of upsurge in the early 80s, the service delivery protests, the riots that essentially led to the declaration of the state of emergency. Now, one of the things that the state knows is that actually it's kind of really, by removing this labor and leadership of the media, it hasn't actually fundamentally solved that problem. And one of the things it starts doing in this period, August 1987, is that it tries to fill the gap of the sort of political vacuum in these areas. And one of the ways in which it does that is that in the Edendale area, it basically starts arming local thugs in order to kind of essentially attack some of the youth activists that have been organizing in those townships. And they start going door to door, recruiting people for Mkhata, saying basically, if you don't want to join Mkhata, then you have to leave this area. And within a very short space of time, Edendale gets polarized. People who flee from these people go into adjoining areas, they set up defense committees, and what was initially an attempt to drive out youth activists soon becomes a full-on war. And it's a war which is August has just over 20 casualties. By the end of 1987, we are over 100 people dying in that month alone. And basically, at this stage, something quite dramatic happens. The fight which has been in this Edenvale area mainly, suddenly the people who are living in this old tribal areas, the youth in those areas, they start asking, well, why are those people kind of not being ruled by chiefs? We are being ruled by chiefs, and in fact, there's a war going on there. We don't particularly like the chiefs sitting on this side of the border. And within literally a couple of months, actually, in area after area, people kind of say, well, actually, we don't want the chiefs anymore. And the chiefs and the headmen kind of lose authority and flee, which panics the state completely. And they send in the army, they send in the police, they basically round up every young activist that they can lay their hands on. And that kind of dampens things down for a while, but not for long. So basically, by 1990, the war has basically been lost by Nkata. And the final throw is basically when a guy called David Ntombela, who lives in this area, takes an army of several thousand people and marches them into Edenvale. He burns out this entire area there. 10,000 refugees get created within a space of a day or two, and then basically just launches a full-on frontal attack into Edenvale. The war lasts 7 days. He loses at the end. He doesn't get into Edenvale. But the body count is over 180 in the period of essentially 7 days. So that's essentially the pattern of the body count. And what is remarkable about that is that basically it's not being described as a war at the time. Although, as Matthew Kentridge in his book on the conflict says, more people die there in a couple of months than in the entire Northern Ireland Civil War over 30 years, basically. So a couple of lessons that I want to draw from that story. So the first myth, which I think is quite a pervasive myth, is that South Africa at the dawn of the modern era has a functioning state. But if we mark a state as something which is has a monopoly on the force of violence in its area, as something that basically centralizes authority, what we actually had here was a state that, over this period, fragments authority. It's actually trying to set up all the new little authority systems all over the show, which are competing with each other, and each of whom have a little claim to be able to do violence in their own way. So there were bits of it that were functioning, mainly the bits that were dealing with the white system, but the system as a whole was a complete and utter mess. And the task in 1994 was not to transform an existing functioning state, it was really to create a new state out of all of these little bits and pieces that were there to begin with. The second point, which I'll get back to later, is that institutions really matter. Those boundaries that were initially artificially created become really important. They change what people do on either side of them, and it even affected the way in which social processes happen there. And the third point, of course, is that we certainly don't want to go back to 25 years ago. So there is some kind of sort of like a almost nostalgia for the bad old days developing, but nobody wants to go back to that. Okay, so I want to start asking now, so what does the South Africa look like at the dawn of democracy? And the picture that we've got here is from 1993 of the first national survey that is publicly available. called the Project for Living Standards and Development, under the direction of Professor Francis Wilson and Seldrew. And this is the first national picture that we get of where we are. And in order to give you a sense of what we know that it's an unequal society. I'm going to do something which is called Jan Pen's Parade. Jan Pen is an economist who in 1971 constructed this thought experiment. He said, well, let's think of a parade. So we've just, in the middle of the Olympics, we want to celebrate our gold medals. So we line up all South Africans in one long parade. But this is a very particular parade. Basically, we're going to start it off with the poorest people up front and the richest people right at the end of this parade. And what is even more, we're basically going to make people's height in this parade proportional to their income. So there's me in all my sartorial splendor. I will act here as the benchmark against which you can see how poor or rich people are. So basically, this individual here is about half my height, so he'd be half my income, about two-thirds that person is full of. So I will now basically play you that parade. So the idea is that we do this parade in a super quick time, 1 hour, we want to get it over done with. We don't have an hour, so in fact I'll speed it up, and I'll do it in a minute. And what you should look out for in the first slide is if you can actually spot the first people that are coming past. There's 650,000 of them. You can get a count in the top-hand corner. So this is minute one. And now up to 3 minutes, can you see people? They're there at the bottom. We're now practically a quarter of the way into our population, but they're still pretty tiny, aren't they? Actually, really, really, really cool. So, 25 minutes. So, gosh, 30 minutes through, halfway through, and they're not even up to my belt, kind of. So three quarters of the way through, we're just about there. Okay, now you get some giants. And basically, so this is still me as the sort of base category. So these guys are now, this is basically 5 times my height. Okay, now I disappear. Okay. So that's essentially what inequality looks like in 1993. A whole lot of people who are very poor and a tiny group at the end that is very, very, very rich. Okay, so how have things changed? So I'm going to go to 2008. Doing that animation took me a lot of time, so I'm not going to do it for 2008. I'm going to use as my benchmark here the National Income Dynamics Study, which was also done here at UCT under the direction of Murray Leybrandt and Ingrid Willard. And the comparative picture looks like that. So here essentially we go from the poorest to the richest. The red line is where the average income is. We see average income has gone up. In fact, income has gone up around about 30% pretty much across the board. But the picture as a whole hasn't changed. If you were to animate this, it would look pretty much like that picture that I did in 1993. And if you used to thinking in terms of Gini coefficients, in some senses the 2008 may even be slightly more unequal than the 1993 picture. Where do I fit in? I put myself in as the typical person, but of course I'm not typical at all. I'm a university professor, so I need to share my income with 2 children. Even after that, I'm in the top 3.5% of that distribution. So I've come through in the last 2 minutes. So this picture of setting myself up as the typical person is a fiction. I am not a typical person in this march. But that's a very common mistake. So one of the things which is really interesting is how many people get their position in the South African income distribution wrong. So Dorit Posel and Daniela Casale show that if you take the richest third of South Africa, so objectively in terms of their income, only 6% of them actually realize that they are rich. Most people think that they are just average, and 32% in fact think that they are rather poor. I show this in a slightly different form. So here basically is a question, which is the same one that Daniela and Dori used. So basically ask people to rank themselves from one poorest to six richest. And here we have essentially, again, going from actual poorest to actual richest there. If you look at people who are really among the poorest, well, they kind of don't think of themselves as the worst. That's kind of, in some ways, surprising. So they make a mistake. But a much more common mistake is for people in the top half of the income distribution to think of themselves as really below the average. So that red line is where you should put yourself more or less if you kind of think that that you're in the middle of the distribution. So really, only even like basically if you take the very, very, very super rich in the society, they kind of at best think of themselves as somewhere among the average. Why do people get it so wrong? There's a sort of theory due to Kahneman, who is a psychologist but won a Nobel Prize in economics for this, which says that basically people are not very good at looking at objective probability. So essentially, what is the real risk of something? What is the real probability of me being poor? That basically what we do is we try to get a mental picture, kind of like, so if you ask yourself, where do I sit? I can think of a lot of people who drive nicer cars than I do, who go overseas more frequently than I do. I can think of a couple of people who are less well off. So I must be somewhere around the middle. And of course, part of the reason for that is that we mix largely with people who like us. And of course, poverty in South Africa is not as visible as it should be. So basically, geographically, they're out of the way. And psychologically, we prefer to turn a blind eye and find ways of explaining away the poverty that we do see. And of course, that is the main reason why we do social surveys, because essentially, that is one way in which we can get information which is not from the people immediately around us. It's one lens through which we can actually look at what's out there. And fortunately, there's now a lot of survey evidence. I won't list all of these, but there's tons and tons and tons of survey evidence available now. And that creates a new problem, because basically you need to be able to get hold of it, you need to be able to analyze it properly, and that is actually a very hard job. And one of the things that we do in Data First is that we archive these publicly available data sets and we make them available for people to download and work on them. And we run training courses in how to analyze them. Now, if you look at the studies that we do have, what do they show? Well, they're pretty clear across the board that there is a lot of poverty, that the government social grants since 1993 have made a difference. So essentially those dwarves at the beginning are not quite so dwarvish, but they're still very poor. There are high levels of unemployment and there's high levels of inequality. When we look across these surveys, however, we find some anomalies. So if we look at the number of unemployed from the Statistics South Africa surveys, you find that basically you suddenly see this huge jump up in 2000, which is when they changed the surveys and they did a couple of other things. Those kind of anomalies have persuaded some people that basically none of this evidence can be trusted. That basically unemployment really isn't the problem that it's made out to be. And there's a sort of denialist strand out there which basically there's three typical types of arguments that we see. So the first one is essentially that the respondents are simply lying to us when you ask them the questionnaires. They're actually doing stuff, but they're just not reporting it to us. Now, I mean, it's possible. Second, which comes mainly from economists, is that people are too picky. So basically, sure, they're not doing anything, but that's just because fundamentally they could be doing stuff and they choose not to, because essentially they have such a nice, comfortable life that they can actually just live off other people. And there's a third argument, one which came out earlier this year in a debate I had with some people, that basically we in Statistics South Africa simply manufacture this information for various political reasons. There's an unemployment industry there that basically makes money off this idea that there are all these miserable people out there. And the main argument for this is that it simply can't be true that we have this unemployment, because if we did, we'd be having a revolution. And I would like to remind you of the August 1987 story I started off with. Service delivery protests, initially at a small level, can spin out rather rapidly. And I hope that I'm wrong about this, but I have this feeling we may be sitting on a powder keg now, as we did back then. So I think we need to hit back at these denialists. So part of that is to deal directly with the measurement issue. So look at the anomalies that there are, do research around that, and we're doing some of that. Fact of the matter is you can't simply take the surveys and just pull off the numbers without doing the right kind of work on it. And that takes a lot of effort and a lot of skills. The second thing which we can do is we can cross-check the information that we've got against other stuff to say, is it plausible that we have this level of unemployment? And there's a lot of evidence out there that actually these stories are quite consistent. So if we look at the people who are unemployed, they are consistently also the people who are measured as poorest. In fact, I showed that they are way less than people who are employed. And that basically, if you look at their time use, that they really spend very little time doing economically productive stuff. They sleep and they do nothing. So that's a myth, I think, that there's no unemployment crisis. So the key question facing us 18 years after democracy is, why do we still see all of that? So why are some people so rich and others so poor? So there are three types of explanations for these gaps that I've been talking about. The one which is most common among economists is that some people are more productive than others. So essentially it's all due to skill differences. And if you run wage regressions, which we do, you find that education and skill is a huge explanatory factor. So there's definitely a skill element to that. But it's not the only story. So these wage regressions tell typically only about explain half of the variation that we see. The second story is that some people get rich off the surplus produced by others. So some of that is just straightforward theft. A more polite word that the economists use is called extraction of monopoly rents, which essentially is when you are running a business and you have no competitors, you can essentially charge whatever price you want to. And off those monopoly rents, you can make a pretty good living. Of course, those monopoly rents are contested. So we typically find that in those sectors of the South African industry, and Johan Fedeker did the numbers on that, some of them are extremely concentrated and show extremely high markups. But in those industries, unions also happen to be particularly strong, so you have to share some of those spoils. You have to fight between shareholders, managers, and workers over who gets to keep most of those. But that will introduce inequality between people who are sitting in some of these sectors and people who don't. The third story is that some people gamble and get lucky. So that is not just lotto. Essentially, a lot of economists think of the stock market as a little bit like a gamble, and you have winners and losers, and you can strike it very rich, or you can get wiped out. Now, in fact, that whole story, essentially explaining what happens in the financial sector, I mean, the way economists tend to think of those gambles is that essentially that's kind of fair enough. You know, if there are people gambling, all it does is it creates essentially enough turnover in the market that people who don't want to gamble can come in and get a fair price for whatever they're wanting to buy. But we've seen most recently in the LIBOR scandal and certainly the financial collapse that we've seen recently is that it doesn't look as though those gambles are entirely fair. And certainly the kind of people who make those gambles got something spectacularly wrong. Otherwise we wouldn't have seen the meltdown. And the reason for that is that the typical models through which we think about how likely or unlikely certain events are, whether you're going to make a profit or a loss, economists typically have used something called the normal distribution, which works extremely well for any outcome which is shaped by lots of little influences. And the best example of that is height. So if I look at height among South African males, essentially that distribution from the Demographic and Health Survey looks like that. I have superimposed the normal distribution, which is the bell-shaped curve on top of that, and you see it actually fits it beautifully. So the normal distribution works extremely well for explaining something like height, where we think that the outcome, how tall somebody is a result of a whole lot of different factors, but most of those having a small influence up or down. So basically, nutrition shocks that you get at various stages of your life, health shocks, a little bit like what goes wrong with your hormones, they all contribute to height, and in the end, the overall distribution kind of washes into that neat shape. Now, financial earnings don't look anything like that. And in fact, there's a theory which says that basically the kind of distribution that we've got there is not influenced by thousands of little events, but it's actually likely to be influenced by one or two big events. So big meltdowns, big windfalls are much more important in explaining what happens in the financial markets than it would do for height. And there's an argument out there that, in fact, what we need are distributions which have a much fatter tail, one where basically, essentially, that don't die out so quickly as these guys do, but essentially just stretch so that you can get extreme outcomes much more frequently. And it turns out that empirically, that type of distribution, the Pareto distribution, fits the top end of the South African wage distribution fairly well. I'll explain a little bit how this works. I'm starting off with the Penn's parade, which we've already seen. I'm going to take this diagram, I'm just going to flip it on its side. So it's the same diagram, but now essentially the income is essentially along the bottom, and the proportion of the population in reverse order is on the y-axis. So I'm just going to look at the top tail, so I'm going to chop it off. And then instead of graphing this line here, I'm going to graph it on a log-log scale, for those of you who know your maths. If you get a straight line, then you've got this Pareto distribution and you've got something that isn't normal. Now, when I do this for South Africa's wage distribution, well, that looks pretty much like a straight line to me. There are a couple of sort of anomalies, NHS 95, 99. These are the anomalies where we're still working on trying to work out what happened in those years. But pretty much all of the others look pretty much like straight lines. So I think there's fairly good evidence that our earnings distribution at the top essentially has much more inequality in it, is much further stretched than you would believe if you believed in this idea that the outcomes is just due to all these little small events leading to the final outcome of your income. Now, one explanation for why a Pareto distribution may work then is essentially if you have part of what you're earning is essentially linked to your position in the hierarchy, where the further up in the hierarchy, the more people you control, the higher your wage should be. So, my summary of the South African income distribution is that there are at least these four elements that go into explaining why we have inequality. So there are definitely productivity differences. There is definitely some ability to extract rents. There are probably supervisory premiums. And then for some people, essentially, there's luck. If you get the promotion, you go up. If you don't, you don't. So the idea that basically the inequalities that we're seeing are purely a reflection of people's abilities or of operation of market forces, kind of in a sort of competitive sense, I think just doesn't work for the South African income distribution. What is worse is that these different elements are likely to interact. And some of my colleagues, Mikhail Pellicer and Vimal Ranchot, have argued that we're likely to have inequality traps in South Africa. And I'm just going to talk you through a little bit what an inequality trap might look like. So basically the idea is that if we have some people who are highly skilled and a lot of people who are not so skilled, the highly skilled people end up getting a huge premium. They get a very good wage. But one of the things, of course, that happens is that teaching, which requires skilled labor, then becomes expensive too. So basically, the poor people then find it very hard to get the education that would give them the skill to kind of break into that top end of the market. And of course, the skilled people, if they know anything at all, they also know how to extract rents, and they're going to be sitting on top of those supervisory hierarchies. So essentially, these three mechanisms are likely to reinforce each other in a way that is actually going to make that inequality very intractable. Here's an additional ingredient. A really influential book that came out this year by Acemoglu and Robinson argues that what makes certain nations poor and others rich is their institutions. So basically, if you have a set of rules that are inclusive, that allow people to use their initiative, their skill, and their drive, then in the long run, you do much better than places that have extractive institutions, which are essentially institutions where you kind of steal from others. And apartheid, without a doubt, had a lot of those extractive institutions. And the real problem, when you look at this thing historically, is that in a lot of places that have had changes, the new elite that comes in frequently gets tempted, instead of abolishing those extractive institutions, to simply plug in there and essentially turn the taps their way. So it's much easier to bully the corporations that are making huge monopoly profits, to kind of get some of your mates onto their boards, or to even kind of crook some people out of their mining rights, kind of like, than it is to open up opportunities on a much more broad basis. So, we're sitting here with high inequality, what do we do? So, there's one argument which essentially says that we should kind of essentially just chop the rich. So Procrustes is essentially way of dealing with height differences is you just chop them until they fit to the average and you stretch the poor. One of the problems with that is that it's going to be quite hard to do that given the fact that so many of the assets that the rich have are also tied into the skills that they have. That kind of youth league type of policy, I don't think, is going to work. In fact, it is probably going to lead to instability and more poverty down the line. Here's another argument out there, which is much more common among our friends, which is essentially, oh, well, it will sort itself out in the long run. You know, that basically the free market is a wonderful thing. It will basically sort out all of these problems. The political problem that we've got is that we can't simply deny that basically one of the things that happened, I mean, remember that there were a whole lot of people that got burnt out of their houses. There were people who got removed by the Gruberius Act. Basically, apartheid didn't just stop people from accumulating assets, it actually destroyed assets among a whole lot of people. And simply to say, well, we must now kind of sanctify those kind of differences by not intervening, I mean, seems to be just a way of actually perpetuating those injustices. So what do we do as academics? So we can comment on this. Of course, our students are the ones who will be running the state and these corporations. And there is no need for people to kind of feather their own nests. That is an option. But basically, one of the things is that basically people do respond to ideas. And one of the things that we should do is not just give them the tools with which to kind of run the state and the corporations, but also challenge them to think about how these tools are used. I think that we have a real need to rethink some of the simple models that led us to the financial crisis and other kind of outcomes. But I think that fundamentally one of the tasks that we've got as academics is to actually use the tools that we have available to us to hold a mirror up to our society and say, this is essentially what's going on here. Do we really want to be a society like this? Are there other things that we could be doing? So I started this lecture 25 years ago in August 1987. And I want to pay a tribute to my father, because basically I wouldn't be standing here in academia if he hadn't been challenging me in all sorts of ways from the beginning. 25 years ago, he gave an inaugural lecture at the University of Natal called King Solomon and the Theologians. And the story he told was basically how, at the time of King Solomon, the process of state building led to an intense struggle within that society. The tribes of the Israelites had been fairly egalitarian before that. They'd been a rural society. But to build this new state required sacrifices. Grand projects had to be built, a temple, a royal palace, fortresses to defend this society against outside enemies, and all of that was built on forced labor. Some of that from people who'd been conquered, but some of that also from within that society itself. So basically what started off as an egalitarian society became very sharply unequal in this process. And there were two types of responses that the intellectuals of that day had to that development. There were on the one hand people who praised the glory and the riches and the power and the eminence and the wisdom of the new state. But there were also people who basically pointed out that one of the things that had been the founding contract of that society had been an escape from slavery. That basically you shouldn't go back to the to that society. And one of the really interesting things is that the story of Exodus as it is told today was probably found its written form precisely at this time in the reign of Solomon, by people who essentially were using that as a way of reflecting on what was going on. So, we as academics, 25 years later, have much less stark choices. My dad gave his inaugural at a time when the lights were going off around South Africa, and the lecture really was a challenge to his peers to say, well, kind of where do we stand? Today we're not in a state of bondage, but we are certainly not yet in the promised land. So we have a choice, I think, as academics, whether we become praisingers of the status quo, whether it's of nation building of a special type, or the praisingers for the free market. We could also choose to basically critically reflect on where we are today, and in so doing, challenge people to think of new ways of governing ourselves and governing our economic interactions. Thank you.